there's in we do a program around anti-bias, anti-racism. And one of the things that we do is talk about the history of institutionalized systemic racism in the laws. And it starts from, this is how bad I am at history. Really, really long time ago, like Egypt, like moving through Europe, like colonialism, like all of it is all racist based resource collection. And the racial part is the tool to improve the resource collection. There were throughout the 18th or the 19th century and turn of the century and into the 20th century, there were Supreme Court. So you're going back to the Constitution and trying to define whiteness, and otherness. And there was case after case after case. And I can't again tell you the specifics of it, but as each person showed up and asked, basically, these were Supreme Court cases that were effectively people being pushing the limit to say, I want to be defined as white. And to see how that was done and to see how the justices wrote about race in each of those subsequent cases, it to hear that history laid out just very simply in like a 10-minute conversation. And again, I'm sure there are lots of details and facts and bits of it that can be added together, but just the basics and the words that they use make it very clear that as times changed, it was just about moving the line to say white versus other, and white got the resources and other did not. And that's how it evolved over decades and decades and decades. And to see the evolution of it highlights the racistness of it. That's not a word. Whatever.
All right. So I want to go into some of your personal experiences. So I'm going to name a couple of places. I want to know what happened in your journey there. So the first one would be Douglas County. Or Douglas, Georgia. Was it Douglas County, Georgia?
It was Douglas, Georgia.
Douglas, Georgia.
I think it's in Coffee County, Georgia.
Coffee County. Okay. So what? Tell me about what happened in Coffee County, Georgia.
In Douglas, Georgia, the county seat of Coffee County, it's a very rural place. The population is majority minority. So less than 50% of the population is white. I indicated that I was coming there to look at a project and that the strategy for my resource was to be funded into projects that reduce the racial wealth divide. So looking for places where the income levels of people of color are less than 70% of that of the white population. And of the 16,000-ish highly distressed census tracts in the United States, 12,000 of those fit the definition of people of color make 70%, less than 70% of that of the white population. This was one of those places. I told them that's what I was coming for. Asked for demographics of the project and who works there and who's in management positions and et cetera, et cetera. And showed up for a meeting of all the community leaders that they have gathered for me to tell me about how this project will affect racial equity. And there were no people of color in the room. So in a majority minority place where I came to talk about racial equity, it was all white people. And when I started asking carefully my questions, it was very quickly very obvious to me that race was not a thing that was talked about publicly in this location. What becomes really sad is when you get, I was able to get the project sponsor kind of to the side and away from the larger group, where he was a lot more open about race and the dynamics in that community. And what he actually had the intention and the desire to have an effect on this issue. Unfortunately, a lot of his perspective was filtered through that lens of personal responsibility and the failure of the Black community to do the things it needed to do. But his lens there also was helpful in identifying certain issues, like something as basic as drug testing, and how they will hire, his kind of pitch for his company is, if we will hire anyone, your criminal record does not matter, your GED status does not matter. If you will show up and work at our job, we will hire you, we will give you benefits, we will train you, you will be on an upward trajectory if you will show up consistently to our job. But they can't hire people who can't pass a basic drug test, because they have to carry state-controlled workers' comp, and marijuana is a Schedule I drug that excludes people from workers' comp. So in Colorado, you can smoke pot all day long. In Georgia, you have it one time, and you can't get a job. He had a situation where a guy, there's just like a minor accident with some sort of rolling cart machinery where the guy fell off and hurt his shoulder. So because they have liability, he had to go to the hospital. And this was he was a manager. He was one of their longest, best, highest quality employees. Before he was treated at all, he was given a drug test, which he failed. And their company, in order to continue receiving workers' comp coverage from the state, had to fire him immediately. And he gets around it by waiting out the period until that guy can pass a drug test again, and rehires him. But how costly is that to an organization? What I found out that day is I couldn't talk about race in front of this community, but there were people there who recognized the system and how it was affecting people of a certain race in their community. The one thing that this guy was doing was lobbying the governor specifically, and was getting himself in trouble a little bit by saying marijuana needs to be removed from this list because it has no effect on a worker's ability. It has no, same as alcohol. Like, you can come drunk, you can come high, you can get fired. If you get drunk the night before, or you get high the night before and you show up and you can do your job, I can't really do anything about it. But the high guy gets fired, and the drunk guy, nothing ever happens, because he's never going to fail a drug test. That's bullshit. Sorry. Cursing.
No, that's fine.
I don't know. So it's weird, though, when you state your intention and then you show up, and people in this country don't talk about race in a lot of places.
Well, you know, I know down south, there's this whole attitude of, you know, race is not an issue in this town because we don't talk about it. Mm-hmm. We never talk about race, so it's fine. No one's complaining.
The mayor's
riots.
Black.
Yeah, there's
that was basically what I was told.
There are no protests. There's no riots. Everyone's fine. No one's talking about it. But, you know, the fact is that the white people aren't talking about it. The Black people are talking. I can guarantee the Black people are talking about it.
Well, they weren't invited.
Right. So, you know, just because no one's complaining to you about it, it just means that they're just trying to get along, or they just don't want to cause trouble. It doesn't mean that racism is not an issue. So for you to make that statement, I think most people are smart enough to know what that means. But if you make that statement, it just sounds to me that you're trying to put on a front. You're trying to show for the outsider that you're Mayberry. Good. This is Mayberry. Everyone gets along. Everything's fine. But everyone knows it's not. So I guess the next one, and this will probably be the last one, so we can get out of
go
here.
Home.
Longview, Texas. Tell us about that one.
Oh. It was actually a similar situation, but a little bit different. The Longview, Texas actually made me consider, like, this is actually my Band-Aid versus cure question. And a lot of where this came from. So go to Longview, Texas, looking at a similar project. It's a manufacturing facility in a very highly distressed census tract. The unemployment rate in that census tract is 24%. And the national average is, I'm guessing 4-something. Like, it's like, yeah, low single digits.
3 to 4 right now is kind of where it's been floating.
This company is expanding, is going to create another 150 jobs, is located physically accessible to the largest Black community in Longview, Texas. These jobs are available. The workforce is kind of represents the demographics of the community. It's a little lopsided, as is everywhere we go. And I end up in the car. I was impressed by the project and the investment opportunity, but I found myself in the car with, she was the economic development director or something. And again, I had been talking in this meeting about race and segregation and opportunity in that community up until this point. And so we get in the car, she's driving me around, and we're in the immediately adjacent residential neighborhood to this manufacturing facility, the neighborhood that's walkable. And she's showing me around and is clearly embarrassed by the economic distress that was displayed in this community. But this personal responsibility, I don't know why people don't keep their property up. This is what, it's kind of sad that this is how this community looks. And it's just like, do you not understand that it's resource. It's not choice that has created this. It's not an individual's choice to live in this dilapidated community, in this home that they don't have the money to upkeep, that looks like this. And so there's plastic on the windows to keep the bugs and the heat or the cold out, right? Like, that's what that's for. It's not because they want to do that, or everyone here is just intrinsically too lazy to fix it. But there was a lot of that. And we continued this conversation. Some of it was actually, I don't want to say super positive, but enlightening for me about what we are actually trying to fix in these communities. What these types of financial tools will never fix in these communities. And so then it's kind of like throwing it up and starting over again. That's the cure and Band-Aid question. But at one point she was describing to me, we've had this whole long conversation about this neighborhood. I'm talking about race all day. And she tells me that her daughter has encouraged her to watch, I don't know, was it Netflix or HBO that did the Central Park 5 kind of mini series last year, sometime earlier this year?
One of those two.
One of those two. Yeah. And her daughter had encouraged her to watch it, and she just couldn't watch it. She just didn't want to. I don't want to see what that stuff's all about. And it's just like, so I said to her, this is the economic development director of I don't want to say a major city, but not a small place. Like, it's a big place where a lot of people's lives are affected. And I was like, I didn't say that ignorance, but not watching it is the problem.
Like, ignorance is bliss.
Like,
if you don't face the issues, then you can
pretend like they don't exist.
You can be comfortable in not taking action. Once you have knowledge, either you have to take action based on your new knowledge, or you will probably feel guilty because you're not taking action when you know there's a problem that right. needs to be resolved. So she didn't want to have to put herself in the position of actually doing something or stepping
outside of her box. But her whole job is about doing something, right? Isn't that what economic development's about?
It's supposed to be, but that's, again, you know, corporate America, government, probably any institution that we can name, there's always a job with a responsibility, but you're only allowed to go so far. If you do too much good, if you do your job too well, you may not have that job anymore. So
just keep it all the same.
Sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's based on the job. It's like, okay, well, your job is to help the community, but it's not written, but you know, based on your boss and your directives and what people say, you really can't help the community
too much.
You can only just, you gotta put lipstick on the pig and keep it moving.
Blame personal choice. What makes me the most sad about that project is they were trying to create 150 new jobs. They're in a community that had a 24% unemployment rate. That organization at that moment had 62 vacant positions. If you are located in a community with a 24% unemployment rate and have 62 vacant positions, what are you doing wrong, but what is this system? They were out at everywhere doing job fairs, paying for training. They were doing what they should have been doing. But then what has happened economically in this country, in that community specifically, to create a dynamic that looks like that? And then you look at drugs and poverty and all of those things. And that's where I came to the conclusion that our tools are never going to fix those parts of this situation. Funding a project that creates 100 more jobs, paying people who are just trying to survive or help their family survive, paying them $14 an hour.
It depends what community that is. I mean, there are a lot of communities where $14 an hour will help people elevate themselves. But if you're in DC, New York, Houston, LA, that's nothing. But, you know, there. I think that's highly dependent upon the region.
Yeah.
But I don't know much about Longview, Texas, but I would imagine that
it's segregated.
As far as cost of living and finances.
Yeah, it's cheap to live.
So, you know, if
I can have a fast food job where the expectations of me are not that great and I make something close to that.
True.
Right. These are the types of
right. So that's where the dynamics. What are the wages that are involved in this whole mix? Right. Like if I have to actually come here and work hard
at a 5 a.m. shift.
Right. Versus I can go somewhere else and make, you know, 50 cents less an hour and have a way easier time and not have to go through this training program. And so, yeah, all of that stuff factors in. So.
Or and then just beyond that, what has created what things are in place that have created a situation with 24% unemployment in a community when the unemployment otherwise is so
right. There's something else going on.
I'm not saying it's the people of that community creating that, making those personal choices that create that situation. I'm saying we've all done something really wrong to have that kind of result and disparity. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
And you're not going to fix it by creating another 100 jobs.
Right. Well, I think we've covered a lot. Are there any final parting words you have? God. Any positive advice or knowledge you want to spread to the world?
I will say I work for a large financial institution, and while you can look around and look at its decisions and still question the glacial pace of change, there are lots and lots of people in very important places who are changing the way we hire and treat people internally, how we develop and invest our resources. And I see that within our institution. And there are lots of others that are also on that path. Some are way ahead, some are just starting. Led by white people and people of color alike, and not with the same false intention that kind of we've talked about here, where you're doing it to look good or to make a profit, but actually saying we want to do the things that are measurably making change on this issue. So it seems hopeless, but Five years ago, I could not talk about race in this way. And I can only talk about race in this way because of my employer. And I think it's not a lot of people, but it's a change that's happening. And I hope it's good that you can do that. I think it is, though. Like, if you can't name it for what it is, if you continue to blame the community, the individual, to not see the root cause of the problem and not understand what it actually takes to have an impact on the problem. And to do that, you have to be able to talk about race. And without it, nothing will ever change. So it's a start, at least.
Conversation is usually the start. So once we can talk about it, hopefully the next step is to do something about it. And hopefully the next step is to do the right thing about it.
We're trying.
Right.
We're doing something about it. We're not sure it's the right thing yet.
Okay. You know, as long as you can adjust course as necessary and keep things going in the right direction. That's the best we can do today, is to do the best we can with the information we have and adjust course as the information changes.
And we do that, and I think my best role is to do it by having this conversation with more people in power. That was the outcome of that Texas visit, is maybe my job is to show up and have a real conversation about race with a white woman who actually controls resources in a community that she's never had before, with somebody who looks like me.
And I think that is critically important. Because oftentimes we have conversations with a room full of black people, or a black person telling a room full of white people how we feel, when, I guess sadly to say, I think the most change happens when another white person tells another white person, hey, this is where we're messing up, or this is the problem. Even though they've heard 100 of us say the same thing, but when another person of a similar sort, I guess it has more credibility, or it's more relatable, or maybe they let their guard down, or whatever it is. But that seems to be where we are today, is we need people of one sort, whether it's black or white or Asian. I think it's the same. You know, when you hear someone that you can relate to, maybe you trust them more. Say something, you tend to kind of give it more of an ear than some stranger or person with three eyes or four legs telling you something. So,
but I think it's you're right. But of those groups that you listed, well, I think for any group, that willingness to have that conversation is a threat to your power. Your white women don't like to be embarrassed, don't like to be seen as different, right? Like, there's the types of stereotypes, but intrinsic drivers. I want to fit in. I want my friends to like me. So do you show up with your white girlfriends and start talking about race? Like, there's a, so on one hand, it's what do you have to lose? And are you willing to lose it? And then the next step for me is, it is white people who need to be doing that because they're the ones who control the resources and the power.
That one, that person, that white person who is speaking up for the other races, whether it's African-American or Asian or Latino, that person is definitely putting it out there, on putting it on the line, because they are risking being ostracized or being an outcast of their own group. But I think that once they do that, it seems as if the other people kind of say, kind of throw off that cloak and say, okay, I'm not the only one that feels that way, so I can go over on that side now.
Or they ostracize.
So it's a 50-50 shot. So, hey, you know.
And that's the fear. You got to live with it.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I guess we will end this segment. And you're always invited to come back and continue this conversation or start another one.
Talk about all kinds of crazy things.
Oh, we won't even start that. Yeah, we'll.
There's all kinds of crazy stuff to talk about.
Folks, tune in later. Hopefully we'll get her back on the show again. And until then, any final words?
I got no more words.
All right. That's it. Goodbye, folks.
Good night.